After reportedly raising some $70 million and muscling their way onto the ballots in more than a dozen states, the centrist group No Labels admitted they had no candidate. Their goal was to put forward a unity ticket for the 2024 election. That isn't happening, at least for now. In the meantime, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. named a tech billionaire to his ticket, Nicole Shanahan. So where does the voter looking for an alternative to Donald Trump and Joe Biden go now? This is The Assignment. I'm Audie Cornish, and here with me is Kate DeGruyter. She worked for Democrats on Capitol Hill before moving over to Third Way, and they call themselves a radical centrist think tank. Kate, welcome to The Assignment.
Thanks for having me.
No Labels has said, we can't find anyone to run on our ticket. Now, I'm going to put this the bluntest way possible, which is that I feel like every person I have talked to in Washington, it's a bi-party system, a two-party system, they hated No Labels. There was very much a vibe of like, oh God, these dudes. And people seemed very unimpressed by them and what they were doing.
I think No Labels was one of the last to recognize something that was really obvious to most political handicappers who looked at their plan. And that's that there was no chance of them winning. And a lot of the voters that they were expecting would be part of their coalition are folks that had previously voted for Joe Biden. And so if they were to succeed, they would be pulling key voters out of the anti-Trump coalition. And with margins as tight as we expect them to be this November, that could be enough to hand Donald Trump the White House.
So how come people don't feel the same way about Robert Kennedy Jr., right? Like his campaign isn't going away.
That's true. He's lagging a bit behind No Labels in some of his ballot access work. It is a very complicated and expensive process to get on 50 state ballots as a minor party. But our view is that anybody who divides the anti-Trump coalition is going to ultimately end up helping put Trump back in office. As we think back to the Republican primary, that was how Donald Trump first got through. We saw a very fractured Republican primary field, and that meant that there was no opposition that could coalesce. We're seeing the same thing in the general election. If the anti-Trump majority is divided in any way, that is all that he needs to be able to win with something like 47% of the electorate. His ceiling is low, but his floor is solid.
One of the things I think about when I think about third-party candidates, like, say, a Ross Perot, et cetera, is that they are often movement candidates, right? They represent a fundamental policy idea or social concept, and people coalesce behind that because they agree with that principle. But with No Labels, there was no principle, right? The principle was like, we need another dude because you guys don't like these ones. And like that actually, as it turns out, maybe pleasantly surprised, that's not enough. Like you should actually believe in something and like have a full, you know, some kind of value driven thing that's going to draw in a voter.
Yeah. And I think there was a lot of frustration because as they were making that very vague argument about their candidacy, they were drawing a really profound false equivalence about the danger that Donald Trump and Joe Biden present and suggesting that not only were they in the same ballpark, that it was sort of a roughly equal threat. And what we've seen is that Democrats passed a whole suite of major pieces of legislation that were largely determined by the handful of Democrats in the very center of the electorate, including folks who are very close No Labels allies. And they seem to be denying Biden credit for those things that they had been cheering for the last number of years, and yet calling for somebody to do basically that same thing, which is try and find a way for Democrats and Republicans to work together to actually make progress in Washington. And so I think there was a lot of frustration. And I think in the end, it was very hard for them to find a candidate because the people that they were appealing to were not part of the Republican Party and supporting Donald Trump, and mostly folks who were pretty fearful about having that become part of their legacy.
Right. So reportedly, Chris Christie, Larry Hogan, the former Maryland governor who's now going to run for Senate, but also Joe Manchin, right, the former West Virginia senator. I heard that there's another 25 names or so on that list of people who said no. Are you surprised they didn't ask more Democrats?
We worked very hard to make sure that folks across the spectrum recognized the very serious risk of being viewed as a spoiler.
Aha. Okay, pause. This is Washington talk for we went around and told everyone not to do this.
Well, that's the truth. We have spent the last year and a half, and our view was it was going to be hard to persuade them to change their mind. They don't disclose their donors. There's very little information available about their funding. So if we really felt like this candidacy was a serious threat, trying to deny them a credible candidate, which is one of the things that they had always said was one of their core objectives, was the best tactic to try and persuade them to stand down.
This conversation got very West Wing in an unexpected way. You know, on a more serious note, No Labels, their leader at one point was Joe Lieberman, who actually just died in March at the age of 82. He was a former member of the Democratic Party. He was a senator from Connecticut. I feel like there's something strange about him passing away at the time that this idea also falls apart. Is there no real path for that kind of independent voice? And I ask because, like, Third Way, theoretically, would be the home for that kind of voice as well.
I think at the presidential level, right now, there's probably not. But there might be efforts to make the primary process open so that more voices are represented in choosing the nominees and ultimately the occupants of the White House. There's been a big push, you know, primaries versus caucuses. Caucuses are this painful exercise where we see people having to vote in public ways, where there's haggling, where it takes hours of time, and you end up with a very tiny subset of the population, the folks, frankly, who are usually most committed partisans, who care to actually invest that much time, deciding who the choices are going to be on the ballot for each party. And so at Third Way, we really fought over the last 4 or 5 years to flip to primaries, which have a much broader pool of voters, where you have a larger representation of the will of the voters reflected in the candidates who are actually going to end up on the ballot. We think that's an important step towards having candidates that reflect the will of the people. But there are certainly other good government reforms that might continue to help strengthen the voices of the exhausted middle. But at this moment, trying to just start from running a presidential third party ticket is maybe missing some really key steps that would make that effort more likely to succeed.
Democrats really do believe that they are the ones harmed by a third party candidate.
That's true. And frankly, that's what a lot of the data that we've looked at has shown, especially in this moment.
Is it just because he's an incumbent? Because the flip side of this is all of this polling that shows no one likes either party nominee. It's not like you're dealing with two popular guys. People don't like their options. So why do Democrats feel like they're the ones who would be harmed?
And it's also not a new phenomenon in American politics. I mean, I think that we've heard people talking about choosing the lesser of two evils going back many cycles. And yet in the end, folks tend to find that they feel like their vote is often wasted when they're going for a third party candidate, because often there are ripple on effects where somebody else ends up winning, right?
No, but let's think about this a little harder. Like, you have these two candidates and it's a very strange situation because Trump is running kind of like an incumbent, right?
Like, that's true.
And it's very rare to have someone who has been president before run again like this. It's only been a couple times in history. And so you have voters who are very familiar with him as an option. And you have voters who have now just had this experience with Joe Biden the last couple of years. And they both are historically unpopular. That's what I'm getting at. Like, how in a moment when both are historically unpopular, is it hard to find someone who could be appealing to the voter?
Well, you know, No Labels, and it's true that there is a broad segment of the electorate that is independent, that they don't register with a party, but there's a good chunk of those folks who tend to lean one way or the other. And so estimates about the number of voters who truly don't have any partisan lean is quite a bit smaller. What we also find is that those people have really widely divergent views. You might have folks who would love to see somebody who's more a Bernie Sanders style candidate in that group, as well as somebody who loves a more libertarian or Rand Paul, or somebody who is just pretty apolitical altogether. And so the challenge for any third party is who is a candidate that can unite that disparate group? And there may not be a lot of ideological consistency between the people who are part of that kind of group of independent voters. And I think this is a moment where folks who are perceived as somebody who is a bit of an outsider are finding a little bit more resonance with the public. Certainly, that was something that Trump leaned into in his first campaign. That might be a theme that somebody like RFK is benefiting from in this moment where you've got two presidents who are basically going to be on the ballot again next year. And a lot of the folks that No Labels was trying to recruit don't really fit that mold.
We're speaking with Kate DeGruyter of Third Way about No Labels, third parties, and the upcoming presidential election. Stay with us.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number smart beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support, your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number smart beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.
Welcome back to The Assignment. I'm speaking with Kate DeGruyter of Third Way, a center-left think tank. Is it too simplistic to think that, like, RFK hurts Biden more? Like, what's the larger question we're missing?
I think it's hard to tell with national polls at this moment, because ultimately this race is going to be decided by a very small number of voters in a handful of states and even a handful of counties. And it's hard for a national poll to really capture with that granularity how this is going to play out. We've certainly seen some evidence that RFK appeals to folks who had been part of the Democratic coalition in 2020. Joe Biden won previous third-party voters in 2020 by 30 points. And he also won folks that we call double haters, which is folks who just don't like either candidate, by 15 points
in
2020. And I would note that Hillary Clinton lost double haters by 17 points in 2016.
Wait, what do you call these voters again?
Double haters. They're exactly the type of folks that a third party would want to appeal to because they're not enamored with the major party candidates on either side of the ticket. But Biden was successful. We all know the margins in 2020 were exceedingly close in a handful of states. So it would only take a very small number of those voters to decide, instead of voting for Joe Biden, that they were going to support third party or maybe they stay home, in order to change the outcome of the race this time around. And so it's in part the very small number of voters and the fact that a lot of them are likely to be coming out of the Biden coalition because he succeeded in getting some of those soft partisans, folks that don't have strong emotional ties to the Democratic Party, into this anti-Trump coalition that prevailed last year.
But you said something earlier, which is that one thing that's distinct about this moment is there's such disparate ideologies, right? That they can't necessarily just coalesce behind someone. And I'm thinking about RFK Jr. And in a way, he was kind of, I don't know, he's like a lab created candidate for, let's say, conspiracy theorists, right? Like him kind of starting in the world of anti-vax, but also the Kennedy family, like, has this very sort of, let's say, tragic relationship with conspiracies. in kind of in American lore. How do you counter him without amplifying the parts of his message that you think are damaging?
Well, I think that there's going to be a pretty robust effort, and we're already seeing that start to play out. Making sure that folks know a bit more about what RFK and even Jill Stein and some of these other candidates stand for.
Do you think those people are all in the same category?
Probably not, but I think that there's a lot of people that don't know very much about what they stand for. The name Kennedy is very recognizable, but this is very early in an election cycle. What we tend to find is that third-party candidates poll a bit higher in the spring, and as folks get to know the candidates, as they consider the stakes of the election, as they listen to what they hear from both parties, what we've seen consistently over many cycles is that that number tends to erode quite a bit by the time you get to election day. I think there's a lot of people that are hoping that that's going to be how this plays out again, but Democrats, I think, widely recognize that they underestimated the impact that Jill Stein might have in 2016. In the three key states of Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, which we call the blue wall states, those are considered must-win states electorally for Democrats. The margin of third-party voters exceeded Trump's margin of victory in each of those states in 2016. She came nowhere close to winning, but the number of voters who backed either her or Gary Johnson was meaningful, and many believe that that's a key part of why Trump was able to win those states last time around. I think folks are determined not to make that mistake in underestimating just how impactful even a small number of voters voting for a third party could be this time around.
What's it like being at a centrist think tank in a moment when the progressive left wing of the party is gaining strength?
It's a really important moment to be having these conversations within the Democratic Party because...
No, I mean, what's it like for you?
For me? I don't want to see the Democratic Party turning into what I see happening on the Republican side of the aisle. I have seen a rush of the extreme voices taking over the positions of leadership, the decision-making power, and really steering and taking over the entire umbrella of the party. We have to ensure that the Democratic Party doesn't follow the same course. America benefits when there are two vibrant, healthy parties that are balancing and keeping each other in check. We're getting away from that right now. I think there's been an effort to paint all Democrats as radical leftists. And I think it's been to our credit and why we've been able to hold on that a number of our key leaders from Joe Biden on down are actually not far left.
Yeah.
But it is impossible to deny that those folks have a lot of currency in the conversations around Washington.
And let me jump in here because I think for a long time, people who thought the way you do and Third Way does, they had a lot of currency in Washington. Maybe I'm saying that because I grew up in the 90s. But there's this critique that if you think about, say, the Clinton years and triangulation, right, which is like trying to hold on to one part of the coalition, but also cutting spending and sort of moving to the right on social issues, welfare reform, the crime bill, NAFTA, that won Clinton two terms, right? But now you have like another, in a way, of this generation of people who feel like shortchanged by globalization, who in a way were like open to the arguments we saw from Trump, et cetera, later, because they didn't feel like the Democratic Party held up their end of the bargain, right? In that centrist deal. And I say this because all these progressives, that's what they're seeing. They're like, wait, we did this already. And it didn't work out the way we wanted to. So why should we pretend the centrists understand this, that they're right again?
The thing that we have found consistently is that our theory wins on election day. And then we are in the minority the other 364 days of the year in the fight about how Democrats win and govern a majority. And so I think that is part of the long-term conversation that is going to end up happening within the party because...
But I like that argument, which is like, listen, we're right on the days that it counts. All the rest of the time, you guys may be in charge or fighting about it. But like, that's extreme pragmatism, even from a centrist.
I mean, when I first came to Washington, there were Democratic senators in the Dakotas. There were Democratic senators in states that are now seen as deeply red. And, you know, we hear constantly the frustration on the left with the reality that somebody like Joe Manchin, who was, you know, the most rightward voice in the Democratic coalition in the Senate, was the deciding vote. But if we are able to have a broad enough coalition where there are Democrats who can win in a whole bunch of those purple and red places that Democrats used to hold, then you've got a whole bunch of different possible members that you can work with to try and figure out a policy solution. And it's not all coming down to one single voice. And that was how we got Obamacare. That's how the ACA passed. We needed some of those numbers.
But I think people also now look at this and say, maybe those lawmakers didn't actually represent me or what I believe, right? Like that maybe on reproductive rights or on gun rights, on these things where they are to the center right, that became an ongoing frustration in of itself. Because it meant you couldn't, quote unquote, count on them, right? If you were a progressive Democrat.
And I think we've seen a real evolution on a whole bunch of different social issues over the past number of years. Abortion is absolutely one of them. The politics of guns have changed dramatically in, you know, the last 10, 15 years, where a lot of those folks that you're talking about were pretty resistant. And now you're finding a lot more agreement across the entire Democratic coalition that some of these things are necessary, and that there's a broader consensus around some of those. So I think the picture of what some of these candidates might look like who could win in those places doesn't match the kind of 1990s, your grandfather centrist picture that you might have had. And I think that's a good thing, right? Because
it's confusing in the Trump era. Like, what is center in the Trump era?
Well, I would agree that that's been a really thorny issue, because midway between the parties, you know, used to be somewhere somewhat reasonable. And now midway between Donald Trump and the Democratic Party puts you pretty far into right-wing territory. And so I think figuring out where the majority of Americans are on issues, not necessarily midway between the two parties, is probably the better way to be thinking about that, because there are a whole bunch of issues where there's a pretty strong American consensus about figuring out a way to solve some of our immigration challenges, or how do we protect reproductive health? And I think making sure that we have space and the politicians who reflect those views in office is part of how we move forward.
I had Sarah Longwell on the show recently. She's publisher of The Bulwark. She was former chair of the Log Cabin Republicans and is basically become kind of like head of the beachhead against Trump, right? She's officially a never Trumper.
Yep.
She said something interesting, though, about where she thinks the future lies. I asked her again, kind of about centrism, where she would like to be. And she said, quote,
I don't feel like I have to build a new party. I feel like I can help build a faction in the Democratic Party that creates a center and a broader pro-democracy coalition that we could all live with.
What's your reaction when you hear that?
I think that work has thankfully been underway for a few years.
There are some people who heard that and cringed. They were like, wait, what? We don't want a bunch of like never Trumpers here just because they hate Trump. Like, that they're not going to represent Democrats and their ideals, et cetera. Like, am I dreaming that up? Do you know what I mean? Like, is that, I'm not going to say people aren't welcome in a new party, but her pitch is, oh, I know what I'll do. We're going to make our home here.
I mean, as long as we are facing the prospect of a Trump-led Republican Party, I think that that is the smart course that Democrats should be taking. As we look at how coalitions have been able to defeat authoritarian governments around the world, it is necessarily by addition. You cannot defeat an authoritarian leader with a tiny slice of the electorate. You have to think about how you build a powerful enough coalition, including folks who can speak in a language that is resonant with some of the followers of those figures, in order to end up ousting them from office. And so, God forbid Donald Trump ends up prevailing in November. It's an outcome that we have to acknowledge is a real possibility at this moment. There are certainly folks spending every day and night thinking about how they prevent that. But if that is the scenario we're faced with, we are going to need to think about how we build a strong enough coalition that includes folks like Sarah Longwell and every single person that we could persuade who might not identify as a proud Democrat to be part of that effort. And so we've had a really strong relationship with Sarah. And I think having folks like her thinking about what that would look like is really important in this moment.
You know, so much of this process of winning elections is about holding together coalitions of people, right, with shared interests. And so I'm kind of putting this question to you over and over again that the Democratic Party has been dealing with forever, which is, how do you bring more people in without extinguishing the fire of your left flank, of those partisans who are like, this is what I stand for, I'm fighting for it to the end? You see it, I think, most significantly in the conversation around Gaza and how Israel is prosecuting its war. The ceasefire movement on the left is making sure that Joe Biden doesn't forget that they see it as almost a litmus test issue. I don't know where Third Way stands on this, but it seems like something that is sort of hard to compromise on.
The challenge that Democrats are going to have to navigate heading into November is a lot of those voters who have very sincere and deeply felt concerns, particularly over that issue, are folks that at a broader level tend to agree with the policies that a Biden administration would support. And figuring out a way to respectfully make the case to them that the outcome that they seek is going to be worse if Donald Trump is the one who ends up in office is the conversation that I think is going to be had over the coming year. Democrats, by necessity, need a broad coalition. There are just simply fewer liberals in this country than there are conservatives. And that's true even in the battleground states. Like, there are just more conservatives out there. We require a larger number of moderates to win, especially at the presidential level. Since 1980, Democrats have only won the White House when we had a supermajority, more than 60% of moderate voters. And so it is absolutely vital to keep that energy, but we also have to recognize that we need to make sure that we can assemble a broad enough coalition to win office and that both are key to doing so.
Kate DeGruyter is with the think tank Third Way. Thank you so much for this, you know, very clear-eyed conversation. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Assignment is a production of CNN Audio, and CNN Audio has been nominated for a bunch of Webby Awards. A big congrats to all of my CNN Audio colleagues, Anderson Cooper, Sanjay Gupta, David Rind, and the team behind the podcast Tug of War. The Assignment has also been nominated for two awards, Best Interview Talk Show and Best Host. And I know that it is thanks to you. The Webbies are awarded by public vote, which means I'm going to ask one more thing, that you head over to the website vote.webbyawards.com and cast a vote for us. This episode was produced by Dan Bloom. Our senior producer is Matt Martinez. Dan DeZula is our technical director, and Steve Lichtai is the executive producer of CNN Audio. We got support from Haley Thomas, Alex Manisseri, Robert Mathers, John Dianora, Lenny Steinhardt, Jameis Andrus, Nicole Pesaru, and Lisa Namorow. Thanks as always to Katie Hinman. I'm Audie Cornish. Thank you for listening.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.